Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Symphony Orchestra continues its season tomorrow evening with a program titled Spirit and Awakening, which will feature my guest today, guest conductor Sarah Ioannidis, the music director of the Tacoma Symphony Orchestra. She'll be leading the orchestra in a series of Bach chorale preludes and The Sleeper's Awake from the Cantata 140, orchestrated by 20th century composer Ottorino Respighi, along with two symphonies, Felix Mendelssohn's Reformation Symphony, which uses Martin Luther's A Mighty Fortress as a final movement theme, and of course Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, the Symphony No. 6. Sarah Ioannidis has been described as one of the six female conductors breaking the glass podium, according to the Los Angeles Times. Currently the music director of the Tacoma Symphony Orchestra and the Spartanburg Philharmonic, and she's been hailed there for her innovative programming. She's guest conducted orchestras all over the United States, Europe, and South America. She's also conducted over 35 world, U.S., and European premieres, and was a principal collaborator with composer-conductor Tan Dunn. She leads the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Sarah Ioannidis, welcome back to Tulsa and welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich, for having me.
This is a really interesting program. Two big symphonies and some pieces that very rarely ever get played. These Respighi transcriptions of some of Bach's chorale preludes. Ottorino Respighi was famous for taking Renaissance works and some transcriptions and creating these orchestral transcriptions, but I don't think I've ever heard these pieces. Are they very faithful to Bach, or are they very much a late Romantic creation?
No, they do. They take exactly the organ preludes of Bach and essentially orchestrate them. The first one is for strings. The second one adds a little bit of a playful wind color to it. And the third one, you know, The Sleeper's Awake, is the big culmination of these three, with ending up with full orchestra.
Now, were you familiar with these transcriptions?
No, I wasn't. And, you know, they're really delightful. They're short and quite glorious. Mm-hmm. Very nice mix with this program as well.
And I guess the brass ensure that the sleepers are awake at the end, right?
That's for sure.
You know, when we think of Bach being played by orchestra, we think of, well, contemporaries of Respighi, like Leopold Stokowski, mm-hmm. and I guess that was sort of a vogue in that time to sort of go back to this Baroque music and sort of rediscover it.
Well, yes, and I think, you know, great conductors like Stokowski, you know, really want to be able to program Bach's great organ works, and certainly it works fabulously with orchestra. I mean, if you imagine that impressive, huge organ sound in a church, you know, if you want to put that in a concert hall, the best way to do it, if you're not going to do it just for organ, is to program it for the largest possible orchestra. And a lot of those Stokowski arrangements are not played because they're simply huge.
Right. And I guess this is sort of a happy medium, isn't it?
It is, exactly.
So when you're learning a new piece like this, I mean, you know the Bach chorale preludes probably from when you were an undergraduate. Mm-hmm. You know, we had to study them from that point on.
Open score.
Yeah, exactly. But what's the process for you?
You take it like any new piece. You study it from a point of view of its content, its makeup, its structure, its ebb and flow, the balancing of lines internally, and, you know, really what's going to make this come across to the public. What's the interpretation that will touch and reach people? So really we're looking for, you know, a result where the notes come off the page and it becomes a beautiful painting.
And with Respighi, he was such a master orchestrator that a lot of your work's done, isn't it? Because the way he writes the piece, mm-hmm. the lines that need to come out are coming out because of the way he scores it.
Yep, that's true.
Well, we look forward to this piece. So it's one thing to look at the score and prepare it. What's it like to hear it for the first time?
Well, you've heard it essentially in your head. So, and you know, fortunately these days we have access to recordings. You know, it's a different kettle of fish when you're talking about a world premiere. I do quite a lot of world premieres, yeah. And that's always pretty interesting. What things you expected to hear compared to what you actually hear. And that's the same process for a composer to a certain degree, because although, you know, you may organize it as such, it may often have a different impact, and that's why I just love working with composers, bringing them to the rehearsal, saying, okay, we need to change dynamics here. And that kind of process happens even with pieces that we've played before many times, even in, say, the Mendelssohn. I'm sort of readjusting dynamics based on what needs to be heard, what needs to come out, even though it's not necessarily printed on in the score. But it's a matter of experiencing these pieces live for the first time together, and that's not necessarily a piece that the orchestra's playing every year, let alone every month or week. So we sort of have to rediscover it in the process of rehearsals every time.
And I would think as you perform a piece more often, there may be something that's maybe a subtle piece of counterpoint or a subtle line that is not emphasized in the score. And as you hear the piece over and over, you say, right, I want to hear that more.
And that's the amazing thing about whether you're a performer or you're a listener, is the more you listen, the more you hear. It's like looking at an incredible painting. It's like studying something in detail. There is an endless amount of detail that you can't simply get to the bottom of it. It becomes more and more fascinating the more you listen to it, the more you approach it, the more you hear things in a different way. That's why I find classical music is just so fulfilling. The more you know a piece, the more you see and feel, and the more the benefits are for you. And I think that's what brings listeners back to the Symphony Hall. You know, sometimes they'll hear a new piece and they'll want to hear it again, or they'll hear something they've heard and they love already, and it'll speak to them indifferently. And it, of course, it also depends on your mood, you know, what's happened that day, what's happening in your life that time. It cannot be replicated. It's always different. It's amazing.
Now, this is your second appearance with the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra, and that first time you're getting to know the orchestra and how it plays. I assume you sort of have a higher starting point the second time around, you know, as far as, okay, I know what I'm getting, I know what the orchestra can do, and so it's, right, it's part of that process as,
yeah,
well.
Absolutely, and I think I'm a different person and I'm a different conductor than I was 3 years ago. You know, the world is ever-changing and so are we with it. I definitely feel like I'm coming from a new place, but I have that wonderful memory and connection with the orchestra and, you know, with my memory of the concert last time. So it's a really nice starting place for us. And certainly this concert, we've got an epic performance to present. And so we've got a lot of journeying to do together. And I think it's going to be a wonderful process. We've already started rehearsing. We've already started uncovering a lot of the jewels that are in these pieces because it's, you know, the Beethoven Pastoral and the Reformation Symphony are two of the greatest symphonic works out there. And to do them on the same program is oh, it's like the field is wide open for us.
Most of the time, either one of these symphonies will finish a concert, but having two of them in one concert is, mm-hmm, is what are the challenges involved?
A lot of pressure, you know. Of course, when you bring in a soloist, you have that accompanying, you know, you get to not necessarily be leading here. You get to follow as an orchestra and be the backup band. But no, we're spotlight beginning to end. And I think that's going to be an exciting thing for the orchestra. I know it's not the first time. I know this orchestra is wonderfully ambitious in programming and has got a great flair and loves to perform. So when we're going to be there on Saturday night, we're going to be creating something epic and unique and very, very special to that moment in time. I think everybody's looking forward to it very much. Certainly I am.
Well, let's talk about some of the music on the program. We talked a little bit about the Respighi transcriptions of the Bach chorale preludes. The Mendelssohn Reformation Symphony, it's sometimes called Symphony No. 5, it's actually his second symphony, was done for a big Protestant anniversary, I believe around, mm-hmm, 1832.
Yep, 18. Yeah, it was the Augsburg Confession. It's really sort of the coming out of the church to Protestant, mm-hmm, Reformation. And, of course, it's very interesting for formerly Jewish converted
right,
composer to address this piece. And he really takes it extremely seriously, so much so, as we were talking earlier, that he missed the deadline and didn't get to put it on that show. But I think this is a very important piece in Mendelssohn's growth and repertoire. It's no wonder that we still call it the fifth, because it is one of the most epic symphonies he wrote. If you look at its content and its structure compared to something like the Italian symphony. It's so very different and so much more epic in a way. And it ties together important motifs, you know, even Mozart themes to the Dresden Amen, and, you know, even a quote from the later Parsifal. You know, everything is mixed in there, and it's one of those cyclic pieces which became quite popular, you know, for Schumann and other composers to bring back and forth melodies, to string the piece together as a whole. And it's an epic work as a result.
You mentioned Parsifal. I mean, Wagner uses that Dresden Amen that yep. also that Mendelssohn uses at the very beginning of the piece as a sort of one of his main leitmotifs in Parsifal. So this symphony had a lot of influence on the composers to come later, but it's interesting that Mendelssohn himself sort of discarded it after he didn't get many performances. He just sort of said, "I'm moving on," and it wasn't published till well after his death. After his death,
it's one of those pieces that I imagine what would it have been like to actually hear that first performance, because it's a really tricky symphony, and I wonder whether they had a lot of rehearsal time, whether they had to sort of throw it together. It's a real workout. The first and the last movement is incredibly demanding on the strings, and the internal movements are much more classical. It has, I think, the singular most shortest beautiful movement for the adagio movement that I think has ever been written during this period. It's like an elegant song could have been out of, you know, any of the operas at that time.
Or well. His Songs Without Words, for that matter,
exactly.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think you've set us up. Why don't we hear a little bit of that beautiful adagio? Here's music by Felix Mendelssohn to be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this Saturday night with my guest today, Sarah Ioannidis, the music director of the Tacoma Symphony and the Spartanburg Philharmonic, who's guest conducting the symphony this weekend. And here is a portion of the adagio movement from the Reformation Symphony of Felix Mendelssohn. Music by Mendelssohn. It will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this Saturday night in a program titled Spirit and Awakening at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. My guest today is guest conductor for the concert, who's making her second appearance with the Tulsa Symphony, Sarah Ioannidis. That Reformation Symphony with the last movement, which we didn't hear, but it's, of course, The Mighty Fortress Is Our God, the mm-hmm. great Luther hymn as the basis for that. That would finish a show, but in fact, it's only intermission on this concert, and you come back with another really amazing symphony by Beethoven, the Pastoral Symphony, the Symphony Number 6. And this is a great piece of music as well.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because though this is an epic concert for us, when Beethoven performed his own 6th symphony, he not only had the 6th symphony on it, but his 5th symphony. He played also piano concerto. He also threw in a soprano concert aria and a choral piece. I mean, it was just, you know, I don't think there were any program notes to say in those days, but it would have been an extremely long concert. And nowadays, this is a long concert, but, you know, it's nothing compared to what they would have done in Beethoven's time.
Beethoven was thinking about this symphony for a number of years before he wrote it, from what I've read. Maybe he was thinking it over for 4 or 5 years, and this was a complete break with anything that happened before in a symphony where he writes out this program, And while it's not a straight pictorial depiction, he creates these moods in each one of these movements of the symphony.
Mm-hmm. Certainly it speaks to me of Beethoven's sheer greatness, that he's able to touch us with elegant, simple, country feeling, awakening on a countryside, to, you know, that epic symphony number 5, which is just so compelling and dark and
geometric and everything else. I mean
it's such a different piece, but you know, that go from the 5th to the 6th speaks hugely of what was to happen later on, with for him to go to the 9th symphony, which was another huge step. You know, what would have happened if Beethoven had lived a bit longer? What would he have written then? But this output is so extreme. It speaks to the force of nature, of humanity, that somebody is able to comment on the sheer variety of living on this planet in the way that Beethoven was.
Now, when you're preparing the score, how seriously do you take these little notes that Beethoven has left about each movement? You know, the first movement is the peaceful country folk gather, the scene by the brook, mm-hmm. The babbling brook, if you will. Of course, the storm scene, you have to play it as a great storm, and then the lilting music after the storm clears, of thankfulness after the storm passes. What sort of impulses is in your mind from these descriptions as you're preparing the score and as you're preparing the work?
Well, I think in two ways about this. I mean, I think one, Beethoven wrote it into the music anyway. Even if we hadn't had that program, we probably would have got the sense of those feelings that are awakened by countryside, by looking at a river, by the storm. I mean, it's all in the music. You don't really need that program. On the other hand, as a conductor, you know, I look at the program and I think, you know, just make sure that this has that feeling of running water that keeps going on and on, and that it mustn't become pedantic. There must be that constant feeling of movement in that rather long second movement where Beethoven is just sort of, I think somebody described it as lazy or something, is totally the opposite of, you know, the Beethoven Fifth Symphony, where Beethoven's just kind of got into the groove here and he loves to do it, and then he's going to do it in another way, and then he's going to replay it again in another way. And, you know, it's that constant variation of his own theme that he becomes sort of fascinated by. And yet, the rolling along the brook, you know, is an important factor that we have to keep in the back of our mind. There's no way of avoiding the storm. And of course, the peasant dance in the third movement, definitely it's in the music, but you have to make sure that it has that sort of chattering of peasant dances and all of that content that makes that playful and contrasting, really.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I think, you know, when we get to the fifth movement, it just naturally plays out that all of a sudden the clouds have gone away, and you know, it's so perfectly written that you can't help but feel that, regardless of whether you would read those notes or not.
It's a great piece to play. It's a great piece to hear. I imagine it's a great piece to stand in front of an orchestra about. I know you love contemporary music, but when you're thinking about like a timeless piece like the Beethoven Six, what are you trying to get out of a performance as you're preparing the orchestra, as you're getting ready to perform?
Essentially, you know, you're aligning yourself with Beethoven's thought, and I want to draw out of the orchestra the closest possible relationship with Beethoven's mindset, and that to come across to the audience. So literally as a conductor, I'm the vice which enables that to get out. I try not to get in the way, but I also try to charge the music and the musicians with that focus, that direction, and the inspiration that's needed behind getting the notes to speak together, to speak right, just to have that right feeling behind every entrance, and also to be part of the bigger picture, that I'm looking at the whole overview, I'm looking at what's happened, what's about to come, and making sure the moment is on the right track, all to deliver the result of Beethoven, you know, which is life on earth, really.
You say I'm trying to get into Beethoven's mindset, but You know, so much has changed since that orchestra concert where he debuted, you know, the sixth and played the fifth and played a concerto. And from all accounts, it was sort of a ramshackle performance because they didn't have enough rehearsal time to learn it. So you're channeling his mindset, but it's a modern 21st century performance, though.
Yes, but the way I like to look at it is I try to put it in the history of the planet Earth. It's maybe a couple of hundred years ago, but that's nothing compared to how long humanity has been developing. I don't think our emotions and our feelings are that much different. We are just reacting and responding to a different set of, obviously, far more knowledge that we have, we're equipped with. But I don't think the essential elements of our emotional makeup are any different, really.
My guest today is Sarah Ioannidis, music director of the Tacoma Symphony Orchestra, who is guest conducting the Tulsa Symphony in a program this Saturday night titled Spirit and Awakening, which will feature Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, Symphony No. 6, the Reformation Symphony of Mendelssohn, and some wonderful chorale preludes by Bach as orchestrated by Ottorino Respighi, who's probably best known for his huge Pines of Rome. But this is a very different Respighi in many senses. And it should be a great program this Saturday night at 7:30. Well, since the last time you were here, you've started at Tacoma, a new orchestra. What's that experience like, going in front of the orchestra? I know you had auditions and things like that and an audition concert. But what's the process been in taking over Tacoma?
Well, it was in 2014 that I was selected as music director.
And I guess it's been a little over a year.
2015, then. And the first year was really exciting. We sold out all of the classics concerts. Now in the second season, we've added another classical subscription cycle. So we're looking at a path of growth, invigorating the orchestra and the community, also starting new partnerships like a free side by side with our youth symphony, and you know, basically exploring the territory there. What is the terrain? What is going to make the Tacoma Symphony as aligned with its people, its population as possible? You know, it's a wonderful part of the world. I'm really enjoying my visits there. I haven't yet moved there, but that still may happen. But I've really been enjoying being there and working with that orchestra.
In our part of the country, when we think of Tacoma, we think of sort of Seattle and Tacoma together. They're obviously, the Seattle Symphony is there. Does Tacoma have its very own musical identity as opposed to Seattle itself?
Well, they are fairly close together. Yeah. So, you know, I would say it's the second large orchestra in that mm-hmm. region.
Right.
And certainly Seattle Symphony's timpanist goes down, then our timpanist goes down too, you know. So, you know, it's a very high level and a very rich musical environment in general. Mm-hmm. Between Seattle and Tacoma, there's the whole South Sound region, which is quite densely populated. Certainly there are a number of other orchestras in the region too. You know, it's typical model of a symphony orchestra today where, you know, you audition behind a screen and whoever comes from wherever gets the job if they want to travel. And, you know, many of our musicians come from Seattle. Some of them come from Tacoma. Some of them live on Vashon Island. You know, its makeup is from all over the region, as mm-hmm. it were.
And you'll be doing a piece coming up with the orchestra just in about a month, I think, that you're very familiar with. And this is one of the pieces you've been working with over the years with Tandun. You're doing the, what is it? It's based on
yes.
the Passion of Bach.
Right. It's the Water Passion after St. Matthew. Uh-huh. And it was one of four commissions by the Bach Academy to celebrate the 250th anniversary of Bach. And they selected four composers internationally, one from China, which is Tandun, one from South America, one from Russia, one from Germany. And these four very, very different composers each got to write a different passion after that of Bach. And this was a piece that I happened to already be working as Tandun's assistant at the time, which is a different string to my bow. We got to learn a lot about multimedia, lighting, all sorts of shenanigans on stage, which is a wonderful, different kind of art on stage that aligns with music very well, I think. And I trained the choir for the world premiere for that, and it's a piece that I've come to know very well and performed as his assistant, the first person to conduct after him, in fact, in Australia. And it's a very, very interesting, unique piece with 17 water bowls. Water, of course, is the metaphor for baptism. And it's a East meets West spiritual work that tells the story of the Passion, but also has the flair of Peking opera, and it also has the very sort of spiritualistic Eastern looking at the history of Christianity. So it has this kind of a Buddhist approach to it. And I love that because it sort of transcends different religions and basically is a spiritual statement of belief in its own right. And I think it's a phenomenal piece. I'm really looking forward to doing it.
And has it ever been done in that part of the country yet?
It was done by the Oregon Bach Festival, and I was involved in that performance.
You were also with, was it Helmut Rilling?
That's right.
Yeah, for a while, studied with him.
That's right.
Well, we wish you great success with that performance. And I know this coming year will be sort of a bittersweet moment for you because you're going to give up your first orchestra next year, Spartanburg Philharmonic. It'll be your last season.
It's my first American orchestra.
I'm sorry, American orchestra.
You know, it's been a wonderful path. When I came to America in to study, actually, on a Fulbright scholarship to go to Curtis and then Juilliard, after that I went and studied. It was a real job, I'd say, study, because I spent a lot of time learning a lot of music and sitting in the hall and assisting at Cincinnati Symphony. But in 2005, I was fortunate enough to get music director of both El Paso and Spartanburg that year, and did 6 years in El Paso, and now I'm in my 11th season in Spartanburg, and a lot has happened in those 11 years, and I'll be definitely sad to leave Spartanburg. But, you know, the terrain, the world is changing for myself. My children are getting older, and we're looking at where is best to live, and certainly to the next chapter of our life. It's been a wonderful time in Spartanburg, and certainly I'm sure there will be new things on the horizon for me in place of that.
Well, I'm sure it will be a little easier in your personal life because your husband is teaches trombone at Yale University, so you're almost not tri-coastal, but as close as you can get to being tri-coastal.
That's right.
Between Tacoma, Spartanburg, and Connecticut.
This is year two of tri-city, tri-state schooling for my three kids. So it's quite a ride for us at the moment, and we're looking to how to change that model, but how to continue to be gypsy musicians as we lead our sort of international life and how that works out for kids. So far, they seem to enjoy it. Well, it's complicated, though.
We wish you great success with that and also in the concert this Saturday night. Sarah, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich. It's great to be here.
Guest conductor Sarah Ioannidis, the music director of the Tacoma Symphony Orchestra, who will be leading the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra in a program this Saturday evening titled Spirit and Awakening. Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall, and a program featuring Mendelssohn's Reformation Symphony, music by Bach, and the Beethoven Symphony No. 6, which we will leave you with today here on Studio Tulsa. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.